You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, powered by Interstate Batteries. From your truck to your trail camera, Interstate Batteries has you covered. Visit your local Interstate Battery store today or online at interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
This is the Land and Legacy Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dime.
And we are right in the heat of fawning and turkey poult and all kinds of new life coming to the land. And that is pretty much the topic of this week's podcast. Last week, we had a great time up in Michigan at the Crockery Creek QDMA Deer Co-op. We went through all kinds of questions and discussions, and it was just a great time. I really enjoyed it up there, and but it's good to be back home. And today, went out, checked on our Stratton food plots, looked at some of the Heritage Blend and the Game Changer beans just to kind of see how the germination was going. Now, Matt and I planted them 2 weeks ago, I believe, or a week ago.
A week ago,
we finished up, and we've had quite a bit of rain. And
golly, we have.
It's been awesome because I think I finished the last food plot, and it was still a little sticky. There was a little bit of rain that happened in between the planting over the few days, and planted the last food plot, and we've probably had a couple of inches of rain since then. So really timely rains, and it's the food plots are off to a great start. I was sharing with you, Matt, before we were recorded. Wow, I really stumbled over it there. And there was a lot of green lines right out through there from when we planted with the Genesis drill. It's really looking good.
Man, they are. And we've gotten the rain. Now we're getting that sunshine. And they've popped. And I'm going to be excited to see just how quickly from this stage, these pictures, that they take off. Because I anticipate, because there's so much moisture, weather looks great, that they're just going to grow.
You know, I was talking to Grandpa. He went with me when we were checking on them, and it feels like a greenhouse outside.
Mm-hmm.
It's very humid, very hot. It's just kind of muggy. Everything's green. It looks and feels like a greenhouse, which is awesome growing conditions. That heat and that moist soil, those plants are just going crazy. So it'll be exciting to watch it all unfold, and we'll be updating you guys throughout the entire growing season and kind of the things we're tweaking and moving and adding to it, or all things food plots, will be updating you throughout the growing season. So,
and that's the cool part, because we've got some plots that are just absolutely brand new to us. We've got some that have been planted for years, and some that had some great cover, great thatch, and others that did not from this past fall. So we have a lot to be able to learn from and share, and we'll be able to do that with you guys and walk you through that process this summer.
Oh, yeah, and we have a lot of, since we have some of these new food plots that haven't been created until probably a month ago, there's a lot of things we have planned that are a little bit different. We've talked about on the podcast with the edge, planting native grasses and wildflowers along the edge, that we mm-hmm. will be preparing throughout this summer and getting it ready for planting this winter. So a lot of edge feathering coming up. So a lot of great topics and ideas that hopefully you can implement on your farm, so you don't want to miss the summer, late spring. You don't want to miss any podcast. Let's just say that.
No, no, no. How about that?
We have something to talk about every week. Hopefully you can incorporate on your piece of property or wherever it is that you like to hunt. So anyway.
One reminder, and we just actually filmed this a little segment, is the QDMA National Convention is coming up. July 19th through the 22nd.
How could I forget?
Right? And it's going to be a blast. It's going to be a good time. Hope everyone is going to come down there and join us for that convention. We talked about it last week, I think on the podcast too, with the folks from Michigan, just trying to get more interaction and get people down there, because we had a blast last year, and that was our first convention. We're going back to speak, have a great topic. And actually, you just touched on part of it. It's going to be this edge development and you know, living on the edge, to transition areas, what that can do to a property, how deer are going to utilize it. So it's going to be really fun, really interactive. And then we're also recording a live podcast down there. So if you do attend, be sure to watch the schedule, because you could join us on that live podcast and be a part of it. So that's pretty exciting.
I will say, you know, we're going to give tidbits throughout the summer as we prepare for this, but the seminar that we're going to do is really, I'm super pumped about it, just because I haven't ever seen a seminar like this, the one we're building. I haven't seen anybody break it down into this simple of a definition of edge and how to incorporate and manage a property in very black and white type.
It's funny. It sounds so simple, but that's the thing. Like it's not being implemented through a lot of properties. But we're going to share why and how and what that will do as a result to hunting as well.
And not just, you know, the simple thing as well. I need more edge. I want to make more openings for food plots, but there's so much more that we can do. And so we're going to cover all of that and all these other type of management practices to incorporate more edge, improve the edge that you may already have to where you should have a dynamite spot, to where more edge, the more species, the healthier the population. And for you deer hunters, the more daylight activity, as long as you're
hunting appropriately.
Yeah.
Right?
You're listening to the other podcast to where you're hunting appropriately. So, if you follow along, you can really change your property. So I don't know. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah. It really will be a great one, to showcase and talk about and present. And as always, there's going to be tons of questions. There's usually a small window for that, but
oh, you're going to be on a habitat panel too.
Oh yeah, that's right. Always do that habitat panel. I'm not sure which day that is.
Last year it was Saturday.
Is it Saturday?
Because I sat on it last year, and we presented Friday, and I sat on it Saturday. And
that's
this year we are presenting on Saturday, so we're recording the podcast on Friday, and then we're working on something else to showcase Saturday night.
We are going to keep that a secret.
Yep.
And it's only going to be showcased there. So
you got to go there to see it.
That's right. All righty.
As I mentioned before, fawning season.
Yes.
And I know, let's just go ahead and say it. If you find a fawn, don't touch it. Just let it be. Unless it's laying in the middle of the road, and then maybe try to get out of there. But it is fawning season. And we actually saw a fawn while we were in Michigan, running through the timber. And it's also turkey poults dropping. And there's all kinds of new life coming. And so it's important that we understand what's happening for us, and then looking around and seeing how we can use that to our advantage as far as our management. And that's what this week, we're going to be talking a lot about some stuff that we've hinted about, or we've dropped tidbits throughout the 64 podcasts that we've done. This one, we're actually going to devote the entire podcast to this topic, and it all revolves around kind of a different way of management.
And again, we always talk about, we're trying to approach things that, I guess, from a different mindset or a different approach. I guess not just to say that we're different, but because oftentimes there's a lot of misconceptions out there, a lot of stories, fables, tales, exaggerated stories that get told around camp. So it's important to bring in a different view and provide that scientific background to support that view. And this is regarding fawns, habitat and predation on those fawns. So Adam, you got an email from a client.
It started as a text.
Okay. Tell that story.
So, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, we talked about, managing for, when we look at how we manage, everybody wants to manage for deer, turkeys, and we tend to overlook the little things, and we tend to overlook doing things that could improve the habitat for smaller game species, such as rabbits and quail and songbirds, whatever it is. And we talked about how a rabbit is usually, I would rather improve or increase the amount of cottontail rabbits on my farm and the amount of field mice and rats and everything like that, because I would rather, if I'm going to have coyotes, which I'm going to, because you could never completely eliminate them for an extended period of time. So you're always going to have some sort of predators. And hopefully through listening to this podcast, you've accepted that they are a part of the landscape. So they are a good thing to have around. But anyway, we were talking about that, and a friend of mine said, hey, I was listening to your podcast about you would rather have rabbits on your property to feed the coyotes and fawns. And he goes, here's a video I got that shows how easy a rabbit is a meal for a bobcat. And it shows, it's a trail cam video, and it shows this bobcat walking down what looks like a logging road. And you see an eyeball, which is a cottontail rabbit, bounce out on the edge of the road and kind of just like hop around towards the bobcat. Clearly, the rabbit doesn't see the bobcat. And the bobcat kind of just like, oh, here comes a free meal bouncing along. And he kind of locks up and slowly starts easing his way towards that rabbit. And that rabbit's still just bouncing around. And then, I mean, it was like the easiest catch for the bobcat. Oh,
so easy.
He just like hunkered down, took a few short little steps, walked his way right up to this rabbit, and then it bounced out in the road, and he just took one big jump, and bam.
Pounced on it.
He had a fresh rabbit.
Gonzo.
And that was a good, I mean, it was a great reminder of how easy a rabbit can be for a predator to catch.
And we're going to share that video as well. If you're watching on YouTube, you'll be able to see it there. But then we're going to post it on Facebook as well and try to put it here in the show notes with this podcast. So you guys can see exactly what we're talking about, just how easy it was. You kind of chuckle, but you're like, well, it's the circle of life. But man, did that rabbit not know what he was doing and that bobcat make it look easy?
It's so easy. It was like, man, even I could have taking that rabbit out with a stick.
Oh yeah.
And so that was just a great reminder of the importance of small game species on your landscape.
I
just think of, you know, there could have been a fawn laying 50 to 100 yards up the road and that bobcat grabbed the rabbit. Now he's focused on that and not focused on trying to continue to hunt for a meal.
There's a lot of takeaways and from this video, one of the first things that I guess I noticed is as a video starts to play, that bobcat triggered the camera, the trail camera. And you just see it, honestly, the first couple steps is it's just walking. It's not hunting, honestly. It's just,
no.
Honestly, traveling down this road. And then as it approaches and that rabbit's out there just hopping around, bebopping, it's like, oh, wait, hold a second. Gear switched, I changed modes, and now I start to stalk a little bit, stay still. But it just goes to show that, hey, it's an opportunistic feeder. It saw an opportunity. It wasn't out there trying to hunt or wasn't in that mode necessarily, but it used that opportunity, was extremely successful. But that's just the importance of, okay, if I have many more critters out there on the landscape that would be a meal for a bobcat, for a coyote, if there's that many opportunities out there, well, they're going to take advantage of it, right? So
yeah,
this
absolutely.
Is just a great example to say, okay, hey, they're opportunistic feeders. The next thing, I guess, that I saw was obviously just the presence of small mammals. And in this case, it was the rabbit. But how many times have we talked about to either clients or honestly folks our age, I know we shared on the podcast is, hey man, we grew up rabbit hunting. Like that was a big part of what we did. But nowadays, not that many people are taking up that sport of rabbit hunting, and you can have a lot of fun. No one's really managing for it. The focus is managing, and we talked about this on the phone as we're kind of organizing thoughts and stuff for the podcast. There's a focus on management for much larger
big
animals.
Game. It's big all about the big game. Whitetail deer, even the wild turkey around here, that's what you go for. You don't really see many people managing for bobwhite quail or the small game species. And, you know, going back to that hunting as a kid for cottontail rabbits, think about it like the same reason you were hunting rabbits while I was hunting quail.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, both of the populations were dropping.
Declining.
And I even hunted rabbits.
For the same reason, too.
Once the quail kind of went away on some of the properties we hunted, we started hunting rabbits on some other properties that still mm-hmm. had a few. And I can remember, man, I don't ever remember a good rabbit hunt on any of the farms other than conservation areas where they were managing specifically for bobwhite quail.
All this stuff, yeah.
And so I think rabbit hunting has died just as much as quail, or probably not as much as quail, but it's died quite a bit just because of lack of habitat. So there mm-hmm. aren't as many rabbits there used to be. And we talk, you know, you go west and how many jackrabbits have you seen out west, Matt? Have you seen one yet?
I haven't been west.
Well, I meant to Kansas.
Well, okay, Kansas, yeah.
Kansas
no,
and Oklahoma.
I've not seen one.
Yeah, nothing. You haven't seen one. And even when I was a first couple times I went out west, I was seeing them. And even a couple of years before you got here, I was still seeing them in Kansas and Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen one in years. And, I mean, the jackrabbit is the populations are dropping drastically as well. So all these small game species are dropping. And I think in what we when we look across the landscape, you'll see these small game species dropping. And there's concern for some of the bigger game species, like the turkey, specifically this year. Wild turkey guys are now concerned about the populations because
it brought notice to things.
And it's like there's we have to, the little steps, the little things have to diminish before the big things. You really get that ripple effect with the mm-hmm. big things. And mm-hmm. and once we hit, once it gets to a point where we're like, whoa, what's going on with the deer? The coyotes are really, wiping them out or whatever. By that point, the small game are really going to be hurting.
Oh, no
they're
doubt.
They're already hurting, but there are still a few of them out there. But by the point where the big game can feel it, the small game are really, really, really
They've
hurting.
Already taken their brunt. And that's why the other portion is, I think it's we're out of touch or out of tune, honestly, what's going on out there. I don't want to say the majority of hunters, but quite possibly the majority of hunters are. We're not understanding, I guess, the life cycle. You know, this affects this, and if that is affected, then the next down the line, we're going to see a domino effect. That just principle, we can see and I guess use that, you know, it's weather's the same way. Even down to crops, like this affects this, and then this affects this. Like we haven't realized that, or we're not taking advantage of the signs that we see right now occur on the landscape.
Isn't that a Newton's law? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Yeah.
Same thing with the food chain and the landscape is, if you were to remove predators, which I think that's a goal, it seems like, for a lot of people, I want to remove predators. But when you do that, you could have a problem with something else. It has an effect. And it's probably going to be a negative effect. So you can't really have that mindset of I'm going to remove all coyotes and bobcats because they're eating my fawns. Well, you do that, you may have a huge increase in something else, another prey species, to where all of a sudden you have them, that prey species, competing with this prey species that you want to focus on. I think of, let's just say that you try to remove all the predators, you have a huge increase in rabbits and groundhogs, and all of a sudden they start eating the food plots because your deer are and then you have a problem then because you're like, well, I'm planting them for the deer. Stop eating my crops.
Yeah.
And it's just another prey species.
Things get out of whack really quick. And it's important to note, you're talking about something being removed from that landscape, the predators, but it's the same thing. If we add something to the landscape, like an invasive species, what's going to happen? Well, that invasive species doesn't have natural predators. They are present in that environment, so it's going to grow rapidly and take over. And basically, any disruption, whether you're adding or removing from an ecosystem, a natural ecosystem, is going to have an effect
on
to
a
some
large
degree.
Scale. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why, like, when you think about it in a very simple terms of, we're not, if we have everything in balance of where we want it and we're hunting, we never really remove more than a third when it comes to the crops, you think about, naturally speaking, you always want to have some for the next generation. So that's definitely a mindset that we're trying to teach and preach to people, to where we're not focused on one species, but let's focus on all species.
Exactly. So there's, I guess, foundational things. There's principles. There's understanding of, again, if I change this, it will have an effect on something else. And before we get too far, that's why, I guess, Land and Legacy as a whole has taken a stance on, let's manage for everything, for the benefit of everything, for the good of everything, and keep long-term goals in mind instead of just short-term benefits. What is this going to look like later on in life? And I don't know how we got talking about this from a bobcat eating a rabbit.
It's fawning season. And we're talking about key principles of our business. So,
yeah, key principles of managing land, whether you are a farmer, whether you're a cattle farmer, a crop farmer, a hunter, a conservationist, a bird watcher, whatever it is, these principles or foundation things are important just to understand, give you a baseline, a basis to build your decisions and management techniques off of.
And it's not even, I'll piggyback on that, but when you say that, this is the type of management that hopefully, and I know this because of conversations I've had on social media with people that aren't hunters, but they are nature enthusiasts and borderline anti-hunting, they agree with the same type of mindset of managing the land for all species and not just managing the land so I can shoot a giant buck, but I'm managing the land so I have healthier deer, healthier turkeys, healthier numbers of small game species, and almost going back to the way God intended it, as in being as beneficial and as productive as possible, to where the way we manage, if done correctly, we should have adequate habitat for all the native species. We should have healthy air, healthy soil, healthy water, everything clean and almost like the Garden of Eden.
I'm going to piggyback on that and take it a next step further and say, not only are we managing for every species, we're within those species, we want to manage every stage of that species, every basically growth ring or portion that life cycle of that species. So, for example, we'll just make it super simple. A buck, a mature buck, 4.5 and older, that deer, to manage for that, you have to be managing your yearlings, you have to be managing year and a half old, your 2.5, 3.5, so on and so forth. Like, you have to be managing, have those all present to be able to have a mature deer and long term be able to benefit from that.
Oh, for sure. And trees, when it comes to same this way. Is the definition, I know we have said this, but conservation preservation is we believe in conservation because it's the wise use of our natural resources. I think and it's very clear from the beginning that once we had cursed land, we were called to be a land manager and caretake over the land. But after the curse, we were going to be fighting these thorns and thistles, as they say. And basically, we're going to be fighting with nature and other species that are conflicting and putting pressure on the way it was designed. And that comes with invasive species, overpopulations, disease, all these terrible things that we have to deal with. So trying to replicate nature and manage it the way your area was managed. So we say this a lot where we live in a landscape that was managed by fire and grazing. That's the way it was managed. And so if we can get back to that, that's going to make it, it may take a little work to get it there, but once we get it there, it'll be much easier to continue managing in that way and have an extremely beneficial landscape.
It's much harder to get it back to that than it will be. Basically, the next 5 years, let's just say, is going to be much harder than it will be for the 20 years following that, to keep it in that same system,
yeah,
or to keep it in that same productivity.
Our kids will thank us one day, yeah, when we get it to where
have a breeze.
They have a very productive cattle operation with great hunting because of the work that we did.
Well,
and
they're going to be the cattle farmer that's on the porch, kicked back drinking lemonade and like, yeah, I'm farming today.
Yeah.
But it's just going to be so much easier. It's going to be so much different than I guess the struggles, the things that we look at and see across the landscape today. It's night and day.
Totally. Yeah, it totally. And it goes with that whole, when we just talk about, man, we are just ranting on it today. But, I think of the farm. I was actually looking at it today while I was checking on those food plots. There's way more acres in what I'm getting ready to explain than acres of the opposite. And it's acres that are not really managed other than with fire. They don't have enough growing for grazing. They don't have hardly enough growing for habitat. And it's just because of lack of management, because of lack of time. But as we progress and we get more time and we devote and we use more efficient machines to get it back, we're going to have a huge majority of the family farm and the Prairie Hollow property that we are able to graze and maintain for healthy habitat for wildlife than we are of what we have right now, which is not really ideal habitat. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you kick out a basketball in the landscape right now, you're going to see it laying pretty open. And a lot of our timber, just because of no underbrush, because of closed canopy. So That goes right in to what we're going to now get into the actual message of the podcast.
Yeah, back to the video. So another takeaway that as I watched is like, that was an automatic meal for that Bobcat. Like, so
you know, before easy. We do this, it was ironic that we were chasing rabbit trails while talking about rabbits.
That is ironic. Great dad joke.
Yeah.
But it was an automatic meal. He didn't have to go out of his way. He didn't have to try. He basically, and from a predator prey standpoint, what a predator is worried about is energy used, exerted to have the next meal. Yes, it was just a perfect captured thing. He stumbled upon it, but still the takedown was so easy. Incredibly easy.
So easy. I think of that little video that I saw on Facebook of the little girl that, like, she comes running around the corner. She's like, do-do-do-do-do. And it's like, ah! If that rabbit only knew what was standing 5 foot away from him when he ran around that clump of bush, right, he would have just been, like, out of there. But one thing I did notice, you said some key points that came to mind. For me, it was the rabbit jumping out into the road where there was no cover. Like, yes, you know, it was a road, but let's just say it was timber and there was no cover there. It went from concealed in the underbrush, early successional, to boom, right out in the open where the bobcat could actually see it. That's what comes to mind for me, and that's kind of the whole management change that we need to focus on, as we'll discuss here.
Yeah. So the important thing that we're going to now touch on is regarding, I guess, a comparison between small mammals reproduction and fawns, deer reproduction rates, and what these naturally occur at, and the vast difference between them. And we've talked about it before, is basically the number of predators that were on the landscape naturally, this and that. There was bears, there was wolves, there was bobcats, mountain lions, coyotes, foxes, everything. There were so many more predators in our area than what we see now. But there also was a prey species more present and more populated than what we see now as well.
Prey species.
Yes,
it sounded like species, you said one, but yeah.
Many, many more prey species. And so if we look right at rabbits, since they were in the video, we're going to touch on a few more, but that's number one.
Rabbit, to me, the reason for that is just because they are probably one of the most common. Now, we'll cover some of the other common ones, but when you go to across a landscape, across a country, a rabbit of some sort is a pretty common, whether it be whatever kind it is, but the rabbits are almost everywhere.
Swamp, cottontail, jack, and so, everything.
That's why we're discussing the rabbit.
So for a cottontail rabbit, they have 3 to 5 litters per year, and the average kits per litter is 5 to 6 kits per litter. So in a given year, one single rabbit could pop out 25 rabbits in a best case scenario. That's a lot of meals.
That's a lot of meals. A lot of easy meals.
On a bad year, that's 15 rabbits that are getting produced by one single rabbit.
What does that tell you? To me, when we're talking animal science, if you will, what does that tell you when they're having to produce that many in a year at that high of a rate?
They
were born to die.
That's, and then it sounds really harsh, but they wouldn't have that reproduction rate if there was not a high mortality rate built into their life cycle.
If they didn't reproduce, they would have been gone at that high of a rate. They'd have been gone a long time ago.
Long, long time ago. So that rabbit, that cottontail rabbit that you see across your landscape, if it's just one or two here and there, you know, it should be probably a lot more, but they're limited probably by the habitat that is present. Now, if you have more habitat for rabbits, you have more habitat for recruiting fawns, for turkey poults, but then you also have many more meals to offset those fawns and those turkey poults. A meal that was just shown in the video that was super easy to catch and present. It was an easy meal. It can't be explained really any simpler than that. It was an easy meal, and if you have more habitat for that, you have more of those easy meals, which is less predation on a larger mammal. It's not rocket science.
It's really not, but sometimes I feel like it is, trying to explain it.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, you go
ahead. I was just saying, let's look at mice. Mice, this was seriously mind-blowing and a little alarming. So if you don't like mice, this is probably not going to help your situation, and it's probably going to fuel the fire a little bit more. But mice have 5 to 10 litters per year and up to 12 in a litter. So that's basically 60 to 120 mice that one mouse can give birth to.
And what did I tell you? Something like
that. The typical gestation is 19 to 21 days for each litter. However, as soon as that litter is born, that mouse that gave birth, oh, mama mouse, she can get pregnant right away and have another litter born 25 days later. That's unreal.
Yeah, made to reproduce.
Again.
And that's why as a kid, I remember watching National Geographic and all these wildlife shows, and it seems like old Mr. Red Fox.
Oh, yeah.
He's always hunting mice.
Yeah.
And it's like, no wonder. They're everywhere.
Right.
Hopefully, if the habitat's right.
They should be everywhere.
And that's why I struggle with this a little bit. When I think about building a house, and now I'm like, well, the yards are just that's a whole nother podcast, and I sent you that one, but
no.
It's lawns are such a environmental
just
headache. Yeah. And so, I'm like, well, I'd love to have a natural, like a native yard landscape, but then it's like, well, there's going to be mice there. And I'm like, oh, I can't even imagine having to fight those at my house.
Well, we'll just release some coyotes and bobcats
fine
and
with that.
Coons
and owls. I'll be out there every night. Get over
bring
here.
Bring them in.
So, no, that'll be something I'll deal with anyway, gladly, to have a native landscape with lots of mice and lots of rats and lots of cottontails and bob whites, all kinds of ground nesting birds.
Mammals.
Mammals. Yeah.
Wood rat, 1 to 2 litters per year, 2 to 6 young. Per litter. So you're looking anywhere from 2 to 12 wood rats produced by each individual wood rat that's already out there. If you were to combine all that together, that's a lot of small game, a lot of prey species present on a landscape that we're not even talking about deer at this point.
Or birds or any of the other small game. That's just the most common ones.
Just the mammals. Right. And sure, you know, how much does a predator eat? You know, quite a bit. But I still firmly believe and know that if those are more present on a landscape, if you are managing and understanding that, basically not eradicating that early successional cover, that's incredibly important to those smaller mammals, you will have less predation on larger mammals like fawns. And you have to have the right habitat present. It's funny, we're talking about habitat for mice and wood rats, but it's so important. It goes back to what we talked about, is if you're missing something, it's going to affect something down the road. And it's going to have, in this case, if you're missing the early successional habitat, a negative effect on fawning rates from 2 points. You don't have the escape cover. You don't have the cover to hide them initially. And 2, you don't have the species that the prey species, to offset the predation on fawns.
Exactly. And that's where, whenever it goes right with that, we talked about this at the co-op meeting in Michigan, was if you look at a habitat or landscape and the habitat is not there to where the small game is lowered, to where there's not adequate amounts of these smaller game species, and you still have coyotes and bobcats, foxes, all these other predators, they put more stress on the bigger game species because there's not this buffer, if you will, or this filter of small game species that they can eat before they have to move up the ladder or the food chain to the big game species. And that's where I think that a lot of our problem, when we see these coyote numbers dropping or coyote population causing a decrease in deer population is I think there's a lot to be said, but I think one of the biggest things is the habitat is not there to have adequate amounts of prey species, and specifically on the small game side of that.
Yeah, no, and there's no doubt. There's no doubt. And
I really gets my blood going when I see somebody focusing all their time or a huge amount of their time on trapping predators when their habitat is horrible.
Well, not only that, it doesn't make sense logically from a land manager, a wildlife manager standpoint, a landowner standpoint, whoever you are, to actively be really trapping and focusing on coyotes just to remove them because you don't like them, but then your deer per square mile value is through the roof.
Yeah.
You're taking now you're focusing a lot of effort, time, and money on removing something that's going to help you in the long run. I don't really understand. If you're actively trying to reduce deer, why are you actually trying to reduce things that are going to help consume and reduce deer too?
Oh, totally. It's mind blowing. I think sometimes we need to step back and think about our theology on this and say, okay, what are my goals here? And for you and I, it's always been, I want to have the most productive natural landscape as possible. And a predator plays a role just like a prey species does. And they're all supposed to work and play their role. And some of their roles may be more food for the predators, but that's their role. That's why they make huge litters every year. And I
know we're going to get this comment. And I understand the point of view that the comment would come from. And the comment will be, well, coyotes aren't selective on the sex of fawn that they kill, or the sex of deer that they kill, and I'm managing for big bucks, so I could have a fawn, a coyote come in and take two button bucks, right, or two male fawns, right, and I would have let those. I mean, basically, I would have taken two doe fawns in that next year. But however, in that time frame, those doe fawns that you would have taken to get to that, I guess, recruit them into the season, everything, they're foraging, they're in some cases literally damaging your habitat because the number of deer are so out of whack. So again, I go back to, like, we just have to be super, super understanding of what we're doing to the habitat or to the environment, and understand, if I do this, what's going to be the result.
Yeah, and that's, we've said that so much over the podcast, is for every action we do, we need to think about what kind of effect that has, what kind of thumbprint or footprint that's going to have for however long. It may be a long period when it comes to a timber harvest, and you mess that up, and it's going to be with you for the rest of your life, most likely. So everything we do has an effect on it, and so that's why we're trying to be as strategic and smart as possible on really just trying to do things that replicates nature in the way it was intended to be managed.
Perfect segue, because the other comment that I know we're going to get is, well, you guys like coyotes or no matter what, even if you do all the right habitat work, coyotes will still take an opportunity to take a fawn. We're not saying that even if you have small game present, that a coyote, a bobcat, a black bear isn't going to take a meal of a fawn. Like, they're still going to do that. Just the effect or the loss, the extreme loss, is going to be much less. The felt pressure on that deer population is going to be much less if you have these other two, like you said earlier, to be a buffer. That's a natural process.
I think of the, exactly, natural process, survival of the fittest. It's not the coyote's fault for predating on that fawn.
No.
I would blame, if I'm going to blame anybody, I'm going to either blame the mother of that fawn and say, well, she didn't pick the best place for that fawn to have that fawn. Or I'm going to blame it on me, the manager. I say this all the time. If you're a big landowner, you have big responsibility.
Yes, you do.
And so I think when we look at that survival of the fittest, the natural process, and the way predation was on the landscape, was they predated on the sicklings, the weak, to where you had this passed on generation to generation of the strong smart, stealthy type animals breeding and passing that on. And now if we affect to remove the predators, we don't have that same genetic process going down the line. So that's something, I mean, you and I can't manage for that really, but that's something to kind of think about when you look at this landscape of how we're trying to really affect it with our trapping and removal of predators. And that's something to have concern about.
So. And again, if you do have way too many predators on the landscape and you need to remove them, then do it. Again, it's a balance. You have to just weigh it out and just not go hog heaven or to war and not even understand the implications of that.
I hate the line. I hate this line. I'm going to kill every one of them.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what? Did you wake up today and think you're God? Like, why do you think you have the right to go and kill every one of them? Now, and it's never going to happen, by the way.
Yeah.
But I think it's, you know, South Carolina comes up where coyotes not a natural, not native to that area. But there were native predators to that area. So it's just, there's always, you know your landscape, know what's there, and manage it accordingly. If you do have too many predators, remove a portion of them. Try to do your part, but don't focus just on one, because if you're trying to manage on for quail or small game species, then you need to focus on raccoons and other nest predators just as much. And a coyote can actually predate on those smaller nest predators. So keep that in mind, to where you don't focus on just the one, but you try to just remove the predators or knock them down. I mean, remove a portion of them.
So here we're tying this back into some recent studies out of Penn State. And if you follow their blog, you can subscribe to it, and they'll send out weekly blogs about stuff that they're doing, research that they're working on, and it's typically really, really solid information. And they have been releasing some here recently, talking about their analysis of lots and lots and lots of fawn survival studies that have been research that has been conducted across the country, across varying landscapes, and lots of data points for them to analyze and understand. So we're going to kind of, in conjunction with that video we watched, walk you through some of the findings and touch on them. And some of the other things we're going to bring up is the habitat in which you're going to have the most success for fawns. And it goes back again to what we have been talking about and leading into, which is diversity. So one of the first things that they talk about is the three different types of ways that fawns die or perish. So basically these studies all put radio tracking collars on fawns. They check them every day. If they get a mortality signal, they'll go in and try and inspect, okay, what happened to this fawn? How did it die? And then they're able to determine that based on if it is predated on. Hopefully they can do a necropsy and look at, you know, bite marks, the way the fawn was stored or stashed, and just do a forensic analysis on this fawn. Or sometimes it's just simple. The fawn was abandoned, hit by a car. So there's predation is one group. Natural cause, which would be like the starvation or abandonment. And then the third way is by humans, which could be a car wreck, could be a tractor or an implement running over it. So those are the three different ways. And to no big surprise, predation is the most likely factor for fawns being killed. These studies, right? And I guess I go back and would look at this and say, okay, which is I don't question that at all. I totally believe it because of the lack of habitat that's present across the landscape. These studies, it's a compilation of many, many studies from agricultural land, mixed land, which is forest and agriculture, and then just forested land. So it's looking across a massive sample size, and about 65% of fawn mortality was caused because of predators. About 10% was humans, and about 20% was natural causes. So that's kind of the breakdown of why, what happened to this fawn and those that average. And then we're going to look at the landscape and the differences of predation in those areas. So, Adam, was it any surprise to you that predators was number one on that list?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Did you think natural mortality would have been higher or less?
I would say no. That's about where I would imagine it. Maybe a little less, honestly. But predators was the biggest thing to me. I mean, if they weren't there, Mama would take care of them, and we wouldn't. To me, it wouldn't take very long for that population to explode and be way out of control. It's about where I would expect it.
On the mortality or the whole breakdown of all
the whole breakdown of it, yeah. But if you were to tell me, okay, here's you've got the three types, mankind, natural, and then predator. I'm gonna say predator, and then most likely mankind being the number two.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not too shocking, but I think if you really sit down and break it down, I think what is interesting is the three types of landscape and how that changes with the different types.
Right, right. And that's what we're talking about next is they have, again, three different types of landscape. They've categorized each one of these studies and then analyzed forest, mixed, which is 50-50 agriculture to forest land, and then agriculture land. And this is looking at specifically the human mortality rate, so that about 10% of that mortality, the proportion of mortality. So we've got in forested ground just over, and it's not even 10%. It looks like it's like 2%, which totally makes sense. If you're in a big forest, what's the opportunity for a human to really come across the fawn and find it and then cause it harm, right?
Yeah. If it runs into a person in the timber, that person is just walking. So unless they have a vendetta against that fawn, their chances are they're not going to kill them. So.
Mm-hmm. And then the other one is we look at agriculture, and that's about basically, I would say, I'm looking at the graph, 16%. And then the mixed is actually the highest. And we look at that and say 25-ish% of mortality by humans in each one of those respective categories of land cover.
So in simple terms, basically, where human disturbance or human mortality was caused in the more broken up landscape.
Correct. The 50-50.
Yes, and it was the least amount of human killing was in the forested, and then it was a little bit higher in the crop country.
Yes.
And I think that you and I talked about this before, but they were actually planning on, they thought before that the crop country would have the highest human mortality because of the amount of equipment and crop planting and everything like that. But as you and I talked, during fawning season, you look across at cornfields and crop country, a lot of them get tilled under. So there's no reason for a fawn or a adult doe to say, I'm going to go have a fawn in the dirt patch.
Right. No.
And so, but where she will is more hay country. And we've heard this, you and I both come from cattle country, hay country, where people cut hay in fawning season.
This is the window that those disbinds are firing up. And it is prime fawn dropping time frame, and that's when they're getting into the fields. And
so that's when they get killed by? Yeah.
And that's why, in large agriculture land, you're not typically farming the smaller 50-50 ratios of land. That's where you get a lot of the cattle pasture, a lot of the cattle farm, which is why you're going to have much more of this hay production in that mixed landscape than you would looking at the agricultural crop ground. Right, you have basically those open fields are either a lot of cover in the hay ground or bare dirt or very minimal cover, debris in the agriculture.
Even here in the Ozarks, If you find just in the difference of habitat or difference of the landscape is where you, when you get into bigger fields, that's when you start seeing more of the people are planting corn for silage. Mm-hmm. But whenever you get in the more fragmented landscape, that's when people focus more on grazing and exactly. cutting hay.
Exactly.
And, which is right there when you look at a fawning's chance of running into a human, if it's going to survive or die, it would most likely be when they're cutting hay. And that happens in the more fragmented landscape, specifically here in the Ozark Mountains. And I'm sure, based on that research, it travels across the country in that same
form. Oh, for sure. You look at Tennessee, Kentucky, Virginia, all these areas that are have a large cattle presence or horse farms, they're going to have such a – they're basically going to take a massive hit during this time frame. So I thought that was – you know, pretty interesting to look at the different habitat types and how humans disturb them, disrupt them, and basically what opportunity, and we're talking about cover-wise, are we giving these, the deer population, the does, to have successful fawns?
Yeah.
Because we're talking, if the best place is to have a fawn in the fescue, pasture, or field, hay field.
There's a problem.
Right. There's a problem of, okay, the right habitat's not in place, or there are so many deer that...
The social stress pushes her to have the fawn in the secluded area.
Yeah. The biggest does get the best areas to fawn. So they're pushing them out into these less ideal areas for fawns, fawning, and you're taking the heat from it, basically. So there's a lot of things to look at and ponder. There's so many variables as well, obviously. But think about it. Think about where you live.
I guess that brings up the interesting point. Let's just stop cutting hay. Mind blown.
If we were to ever see that in our lifetime, I would tip my hat to a lot of people.
We will hopefully see it on our farms, but trying to do that over the landscape, it probably ain't ever going to happen. So... but I think there are ways to avoid it, and that is by improving the habitat outside of those fields to where they have their fawns not in your fescue, perennial cool season grass hay fields. So yes. I think about it, how many times, so we ought to have, or I just talked to a couple people that run custom hay business and see how many fawns they run over in a year of cutting hay, because it almost probably make us throw up because I'm sure it's a lot. I know as a kid, there was one time where they jumped four fawns out of the hayfield. They didn't kill any of them. They ran them out of there, but it's like they could have if they weren't paying attention.
Sure, sure.
But I think they probably knew, go to that Keith farm, you better not run over a fawn or you're going to have two mad boys after you.
Right.
So,
and you know, I go back and forth about some of the quality of that cover. Ideal? No. But I've also seen it could be a lot worse, and where fawns get stashed. Because when I was working at Quantico, we were doing the fawn survival studies, and some of the areas, there's the main side, and then there's all these training areas. Some of the fawns that we would find were tucked up against buildings. Basically, a doe would put their back against a building and say, you know, nothing's coming from here, so then you could see everything approaching, and hopefully that fawn would be able to run. So we'd get calls in, hey, I got a fawn over here by this chain link fence and nestled by some taller grass or this and that. I look at that hayfield, I'm like, I've seen a lot worse.
Yeah.
You know, it's cool. There's some cover. But my gosh, there's better. There's early successional habitat. There's edge feathering, soft edges. There's clear cuts that you could be doing.
Fallow fields.
Yeah, fallow fields, which... never ever gets talked
woodlands,
about ever.
Savannas.
So the habitat types could be much better than what we're seeing. A lot of fawns either perishing in or hopefully if they do wait to cut, they are getting through and making it. But
are old enough to run out of the way.
Yeah, no doubt.
That brings up now. It almost slipped my mind, and I'm trying to rally the troops up in my head and between my ears to remember what the point was. And doggone it, I'm afraid it slipped my mind. But
did the troops retreat?
They did. They went home for dinner. I'll think of it here in a little while because it was a point that we wanted to address. I know we talked about it early on. It must have been a real good one too, if I can't remember it. But
right.
I think that just the whole mindset of cutting hay and understanding where you can put better fawning habitat, and that goes right into what we just said of there's so many different things we can do to improve it with the edge feathering to where you can make these areas right on the edge of your food plot. It's just the additional work, and that's why it's so beneficial, because you're not only increasing the chances of a fawn surviving, but you're improving the edge to where your mature deer feel safer in those areas because they have better escape cover, or they're just more, they feel more comfortable being in your food plots.
Or if I was in my shoes with this knowledge when I was 10 to 20 back home, what I would do and recommend is, well, my dad, he's never going to stop cutting hay. That's just part of it. That's the way, honestly, we have to make a living. There's just no way around that. So I would be along the timber line, I would be doing these soft edges, knowing that, okay, they want to be here, but I can increase this fawning cover so much better if I just create this edge, and that could be done with a chainsaw. I could have done that during that time frame, but I didn't have obviously the understanding and knowledge that I do now. But I just want to do something instead of saying, well, that's just the way it is. I want to do something. So hopefully that's going to help someone say, next spring, I'm not going to lose as many fawns in the hayfield. I'm going to give them a better opportunity to survive. I'm not going to affect dad. I'm not going to ask him to, you know, not cut all of it or take an acre out so I can have a food plot. I'm just going to make my edge of the timber and field a soft edge and blend it so much better.
Let's just go back to that social stress. When we talk about the mature does or the adult does, the dominant ones will get the best areas for fawns. That's why it's important to break up that landscape, to have edge feathering around your food plots, mm-hmm. to have those planted native grasses within the perimeter of the food plots, all your food plots. That's why it's important to have broken up clear cuts or bedding thickets, more aggressive TSI in pockets, to where you have just scattered across the landscape better fawning habitat, to where every doe on your place that's makes a large part of her life on there, she has a place to go have a fawn where that fawn has a great chance of surviving.
Mm-hmm.
To where you're not having 5 or 10 or however many does that have ideal, and the other ones have to go lay out in the fescue and hope that they don't get run over by the tractor. So that's why it's important to break it up, fragment your landscape, and provide that opportunity for all your does and turkeys to have nests right there amongst all that stuff as well, to where you have an opportunity for a very healthy population down the road.
You know, we get so upset about fawns that don't make it, but do we have success or do we feel enjoyment, fulfillment, I guess, of when they do survive? You know what I mean? Like, we should be celebrating, oh, I had this many survive. I'm seeing this many recruit when they start showing up trail camera, you know, August. Oh, this was much better than this past year. Maybe it's because of the work you've done. Instead of just fretting over, oh, I lost one. I found the remains, or my farmer, he mowed over it. There's something that can be said about using that energy of disappointment and putting it towards habitat improvement. So then you're not focused on the bad, but then the good of how many more are recruited in the years to come.
I remember what it was. The troops came back.
Yeah, there they are.
So when we talked about the mice and the rabbits and everything, where they had so many, on average, an adult doe is going to have 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, very rarely, you'll see triplets in the wild, because that brings up, did you see the video of the fawn that had quads?
Uh-uh.
And
the doe that had quads?
Did I say fawn? Yeah. Wow, that's really something. The doe that had fawn had quads. My wife showed it to me, and I'm like, really? Well, I go in there, and then she's laying in, like, it looks like a yard, mm-hmm. high fence all around her. Another doe comes walking by, like, oh, Susie, you're having your fawns. Oh, that's cool.
Nice.
She had
tag.
4 of them. Yeah. Cool necklace.
Yeah.
And so I think about that, like, In the wild, you're going to see 1 or 2, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
You see 2 a lot more when the population is really healthy. To where you compare that to a rabbit or a field mouse, and you think, okay, well, if a doe has 1 and that dies of predation, and that happens on a regular occurrence throughout the property, population is going to hurt.
Yep.
But if you have more rabbits and all those other small game species, to where hopefully they're feeding, and those fawns have a chance to survive, that's the way it was intended. So
I guess, and this is just a number standpoint, not a value of the animal, but you have more to lose with rabbits and these mice and voles on a property than you do with deer, because there's just more of them. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So the third main thing out of this study, and this is talking about just the predators, the breakdown of predators, there was three main predators that that basically accounted for all the predation on fawns. And it was black bears, and they said canine species, which will include coyotes and domestic dogs, and then bobcats. They kill 83% of the fawns that died of predation. Those three kind of took the cake there with bringing the bulk of predation. That yes, domestic dogs do take some, but they can't, basically in the measuring of the bite marks and the teeth marks and all this stuff, you can't determine whether it's a domestic dog or coyote very, very easily. So they just kind of group them together. But all those three, black bears, coyotes, domestic dogs, bobcats, 83%. The other 17%, 14 was unknown predators. They just could not tell based on the what was left, the remains.
Bigfoot.
Yeah, right. And then 3% was a random fox.
Aliens.
Aliens, yeah. Sucked up in the UFO.
Oh, so, hopefully, I hope this podcast opens some eyes, opens some ears, and gets people a little more aware of managing for the small game species. You know, the end of this, it's just me trying to slide in and justify people managing for quail.
No. Yeah.
I'm totally kidding. But if you manage for quail, that was a question I had today on habitat managers. The guy asked, is good quail habitat good deer habitat and vice versa? It was like, well, good quail habitat usually means good deer habitat, but just because you have deer doesn't necessarily mean you have quail.
Absolutely.
Big difference. And that goes with when you ask about food plots, it's like, well, you can't plant monocultures for quail and expect them to thrive. They need the diversity of plants to bring in a diversity of insects, to bring in a diversity of food during the winter months. So,
yep.
Definitely a big difference. So if we can manage for these small game species and bring their populations back, I promise you it will help out your big game species in the long run.
And guess where all that starts? Working in the habitat.
For sure.
Done. I hope that was at least a little insightful for some people and gave some direction on what to do, how to analyze what's going on in the habitat, and know before you do something. We talked about, Adam, most common land management failures, not have a plan. And the plan is important to understand what am I doing here, where am I going, understand the direction. So
for sure, let's do our would you rathers.
Okay.
Would you rather, I'm just throwing one out there, would you rather fight a mountain lion or a grizzly bear? We're camping out west and we hear something outside the tent. And I say,
wait, we're sharing a tent?
Yeah, well, yeah, we're camping. I ain't packing two tents in there. Well, there's all of us. I was picturing a canvas wall tent.
Oh, okay, so thank God.
There's
Hope we're doing them little pup
tents. You brought your earplug. Yeah. It's a one-man tent. We got to share it because you're too scared to sleep outside with the bears.
Top bunk.
And snakes. So anyway, if there's something outside and you go outside to fight it off, would you rather it be a grizzly bear or a mountain lion?
Oh, God. Dude, I'm in the fetal position either way.
Yeah. I think I'd rather fight a grizzly bear than a mountain lion.
Really?
Yeah. Cats are mean, man.
They are mean. They're agile.
And I know how I'm going to handle a grizzly bear. I'm going to stick my hand down his throat. I think a guy survived because of that.
Yeah, the one guy.
I'll be the second guy. Yeah, it looked like it ate his arm first.
Right? So. Oh, gee whiz. Okay, you threw that one out there. Would you rather, knowing the predation rate, the high predation rate, and your potential role in life, would you rather be born a rabbit or a mouse and have lots of little brothers and sisters?
Oh, man. A mouse. I feel like I have a better chance at hiding.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good luck, brother.
Yeah. All right. That was two very random would you rathers, but we were kind of tired of doing the whole other stuff for this week. So anyway, hopefully you guys enjoyed this week's podcast. Please go give us a review on our Facebook page or over on Stitcher or iTunes. There's been a couple really nice ones here lately, and you guys, when we get the hats ready, you're going to get one, I promise you. So,
and those are still progressing. We've got lots of cool stuff coming with those, lots of new advancements.
All right, sounds good. Hopefully, we will catch you next time.
We'll see ya. Thanks for listening to another episode of Land and Legacy's Hunting and Habitat Management Podcast. If you like what you hear, check us out at landandlegacy.tv. You can submit a viewer question right there, and we're answering on the podcast, or find us on Facebook and Instagram.
Feels pretty good knowing that from the beginning of time, God has called us to be a caretaker, gamekeeper, a manager of the land. So with that being said, don't you think we should do it all for the love of the land and the glory to God? Yeah.